You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Meine Damen und Herren, hallo. Herzlich willkommen zur Golfschau-Episode Nummer 12 ist es, glaube ich. Ich bin Frank Förster, ich begrüße Sie. Wir haben heute einen ganz, ganz besonderen Gast. Wir haben heute unsere erste Show. Wir sind ja zweisprachig, bilingual manchmal nur auf Deutsch. Heute haben wir unsere erste Show auf Englisch. Und es lohnt sich, ihr, Sie, meine Herrschaften, bekommen heute einen Insight into American or into professional golf von einem Professional Caddy auf der PGA Tour. Und es passt sehr gut, weil es ja, wir gerade sind hier am Anfang der Masters. Heute spielen die Frauen, die Amateure. Nächste Woche geht's dann los. Er hat bei den Masters gecaddied. Da werden wir drüber sprechen. Er ist in Augusta geboren, wohnt in der Nähe von Augusta. Es ist mein neuer Freund und ich bin ganz stolz, dass er heute hier ist. Herzlich willkommen, Drew Hinesley. Hey Drew, how's it going? Good to see you.
Frank, thanks for having me on. Hello to all our German friends.
Yes, well, I got to tell you what an honor and what a pleasure it is to have you on. I keep saying it again and again and again. All we are is what our guests are, and our guest list is second to none. And to have somebody like you with your expertise, your background, your knowledge, and your human qualities to be willing to share all this with us and with the German golfing public is phenomenal. So I'm the one that says thank you, and I'm glad you're here. We're gonna have some fun. We're gonna have a lot of things to talk about. You are born in Augusta, Georgia.
Born in Augusta, Georgia, at St. Joseph's Hospital. It's now University Hospital. It's about 4 miles from the gate of Augusta National Golf Club. Not a bad place to enter the world.
Not a bad place at all. And what was that? Was that an instant connection to the game for you?
No, anything but. I had an uncle, my mother's youngest brother, who played collegiate golf. But I grew up in the United States of America, where baseball, football, and basketball are our three main sports that most young people gravitate to. And I was a very seasonally focused kid. Whatever was in season, that's what I would play with my friends. That's what I played in youth sports, and then into high school. Was very, very fast and was good at football, but very small and undersized to go and play at the collegiate level. But I was really good at baseball, and tried to go play at college, had a chance to go play at some smaller colleges, decided to go try to walk on at a big college, which was a bad decision, but came very close to making the team. I was a left-handed pitcher, and that was what I did. That was who I was. That was my identity. I remember growing up, my grandfather, who saw his son go play college golf, kept saying to my mother and father, "You need to get that boy in golf. You need to get that boy in golf." He saw that I had this unbelievable hand-eye coordination, but he also saw that I wasn't blessed with great size or strength that you would need to matriculate through the higher levels of the game of any sport. But he knew golf, it didn't matter how big I was. You know, we see the greats of the game, the Gary Players, and now we see, you know, Rory McIlroys and Justin Thomas's, guys that aren't physically imposing, but they understand the technique, and their hand-eye coordination allows them to be great. And my grandfather saw that I possessed that, and he thought, boy, if we could direct his energy into that. And I just never did. And in the United States, in the late 80s and early and mid 90s, when I was coming of age, Golf was an old man sport. It was about, it was a sport where people didn't know how to dress. They wore plaids and stripes together. It just didn't make any sense. And then suddenly in April of 1997, I was 18 years old or 17, about to turn 18, and golf got real cool when a guy named Tiger Woods won the Masters, and it brought me to the game. So Tiger not only has put food on my table as a working professional in professional golf, but he brought me to the game as a fan. So I owe a lot to Tiger Woods, both in my interest in the game and also the living I've been able to make. So that's when I was introduced to golf. And after washing out of college baseball and college in general, I always say golf kind of found me. I was working odd jobs here and there, and I went and went over to Eastlake Golf Club with a friend of mine to pick up a paycheck just to see the course, something to fill a couple hours on a Saturday afternoon. And the caddy master, the guy who manages the staff of caddies, he said, "Hey, you're an athletic guy. You know, you're young. What are you going to do the next few years?" Didn't have an answer. He said, "Why don't you come out here and carry bags for this summer? See if you like it." And I found out really quick. I was really good at telling other people how to play the game, although I had no skill myself. I understood the mental side. And 2 months into my career at Eastlake, I caddied for a gentleman by the name of Stuart Sink, who actually taught me how to read a yardage book as we read it today. And that was in the summer of 1998. Happy to say I'm still friends with Stuart to this day. But yeah, that's kind of how I got introduced to golf. It found me completely. Right. I never saw, as a young kid, I never even watched the Masters and said, "That's what I want to do." Right. I never had that ambition. It's just something that kind of stumbled into my life and landed in my lap. And I've been fortunate to have some success along the way in that career.
What was that before Stuart Sink won the Open?
He won the Open in 2009.
Oh, so after,
yeah, okay. 11 years.
I remember.
A decade before he beat Mr. Watson. And he looked at Mr. Watson on the 18th green at the prize giving there at Carnoustie. And he said, "Mr. Watson, I'm really sorry." Mr. Watson looked at him and said, "Son, my name's on that trophy 5 times. Don't ever apologize for winning that thing." And he never apologized again.
But that is some amazing story. I mean, just to reiterate, I mean, Eastlake is not just another Muni, and not that there's anything wrong with Munis at all. I love Muni golf. I mean, Eastlake is the home course and home club of Bobby Jones.
And I had no idea when I went that day. I had really didn't know who Bobby Jones was. I had some idea that he was connected with the Masters tournament, but again, had no understanding of history of golf, of the game at all. It was kind of dumb luck that I grew up 20 minutes down the road from that golf course, and right. has kind of been the place where I've attached myself to the game for 20 years.
Right. And Eastlake is still, I mean, I think part of the FedEx Cup playoffs are played there, right?
It is the finale. It's the final. Right. It's where the Tour Championship and the FedEx Trophy is awarded every year.
Right. Yeah. It's must be an amazing place. I never had the chance to go to Augusta or to Eastlake. Playing most of my golf up on the East Coast and in the tri-state area in New York and Connecticut and Westchester, New Jersey, that kind of stuff. It's interesting because doing the math when you talk about you were 18, then it sounds like you're exactly 20 years younger than me. And my first exposure to the game was also in through caddying. I moved to the States with my folks for the first time in 1974 from Germany. I was a tennis player. We were, you know, I was 13. We were into Bjorn Borg, and we wanted to be like, we loved Chris Everett and Yvonne Goolagong, and golf was just not sexy at all. And we moved to New Jersey, and I didn't speak a word of English. I went to this school in eighth grade, and nobody spoke a word of German. So finally, a kid from the neighborhood somehow took me. He says, "Come with me. We can make some money." I'm like, okay. So he took me. This was in Morristown, New Jersey. And I believe we went to the Morristown Country Club. And he says, no, we're going to go caddy there. I had no idea what caddying was. So he practiced with me, and he would be like, he would be the player, and I would be, you know, in the backyard, and I would be the caddy. And he would be like, oh, hand me the 7-iron, son. And I'm like, you know, I'm thinking to myself, this sucks, in German, obviously, because I didn't speak English. But finally, he took me to the place, and we sat, you know, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. It's like Caddyshack, like the movie. We sat in the sand pit, and the caddy master would come, and we were all like 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old boys, some older guys, and he would like tap the guy on the shoulder and says, you go, this one, this one, this one. I was the last one sitting there all alone. Somebody came to play. He picked me. I had no idea what I was doing, and I didn't start playing. I thought it was the worst thing in the world. I didn't start playing till, you know, 10 years later. So very, not quite as sexy as your story, but that's how, you know, that's how I got to first time find out about golf. So you became a caddy, and it's fascinating to me. Number one, well, you know, there's always a demand for left-handed pitchers. You know, having been a Yankee for still being a Yankee fan, lefties are always tough to come by. So you became a caddy without really playing the game. I think for most players here, amateurs, weekend golfers in Germany, there's no caddies here. You know, everybody has their electric push cart, whatever, you know, nobody carries really. So golfers here are mostly exposed to caddies when they go on holiday to Turkey, to Egypt, where, you know, to the States, wherever, where there are caddies available. And I think, you know, for many of them, a caddy is just a guy that carries the clubs, you know, which you can't really blame them for, because they have no idea. They don't maybe watch the tour on TV and everything like this. But for those of us who do and who follow it closely, we know the value of the caddy. Maybe, Drew, you can walk us through some of the skills required to be a good caddy. Obviously, golf is not playing golf is not one of them, which might be a shocker.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly at the professional level, you are getting more and more guys that know how to play the game. I have learned myself how to play at a high level. I have tried to qualify for the U.S. amateur and events like that, just to give you an idea of where my game has progressed to. A lot of it just kind of through being around the professionals, watching what they do, trying to mimic. Totally self-taught myself, but being around some of the people I've been around, it's not too bad just to try to emulate some of the things they do. But, you know, the guy who carries the bag, some days that is the job, and it actually takes skill to understand, even at the professional level, how to just shut up and carry the bag. It actually takes restraint to stay out of the way. You know, a funny story from my LPGA days, a good friend of mine had a friend come out for the week to caddy for her, and she shot 66 first round, 6 under par, leading the tournament. Second day, she struggled a little bit, I think shot 1 over 73, and kind of got to the car and looked at her friend and said, you know, you kind of left me hanging out there a couple times today. I really needed you. And he looked at her and he said, well, it was a lot easier yesterday when you were shooting 66. And she said, well, yeah, anybody can carry the bag when I'm shooting 66. It's, you know, it's changing a 73 to a 71 or a 72 to a 70. That's where the skill of a professional comes in. It's when things are going a little rough, that's when you need to maybe step in and offer a swing thought, or remind them to breathe, slow things down, talk through a shot a little more. But when a player is playing good, I always say, you know, I'm a baseball guy, so a lot of my analogies come from baseball, and a good caddy is like a good umpire. When they're doing their job properly, you don't notice they're there. Mm-hmm. And that could even apply to the player themselves. Sometimes you just let the player, let the player go. You provide certain information at certain points, but it's the player's decision-making. If the player's making good decisions and the swing is where it needs to be, there's really not much a caddy can do to help at that stage. The only thing you can do is hurt. And, you know, I'll sit and watch, you know, golf in a hotel room, maybe with a player. You know, we're staying in a hotel room or something together, and we're in the morning wave and we're watching the afternoon coverage. over the years, I'll just ask questions. Hey, with this chip shot, what would you like to hear? And more often than not, the player will say nothing. There's nothing you can offer me right there that I can't discover myself by walking up and seeing the pitch of the green, knowing what the grass is doing. There's nothing you can say that can offer help. All you can do is get in the way here. And more often than not, that's the case. Really, at that stage, especially at the professional level, your job is crowd control and making sure, you know, your player's not getting ready to hit a chip shot while somebody's 30 yards behind him about to hit a tee shot that could disrupt their thought process. That's really, you're more crowd control, external forces than you are trying to affect your player in a good or bad way. So, again, just carrying the bags some days on tour and even at the country club level is what you're asked for. I remember one day I was out at Eastlake mm-hmm. with the CEO of Coca-Cola and the chief operating officer of Coca-Cola. And they had two executives from Goldman Sachs that were hosting them. And they were talking about how to monetize Coca-Cola's debt to better position them globally in the next decade. That was a carry the bag and shut up kind of day. That was billions of dollars being discussed. I didn't need to get in the way that day either. So right. You kind of have to gauge who the audience is, what they're needing from you. There's days right. where I will have a friend of mine come from out of town. He'll bring three guests. He'll tell them all about me, say, hey, you know, next week is Masters Week here in Georgia. So I'll get a lot of, I call it carnival barker rounds, where they want me to tell all the stories. Basically, what we're doing here in this podcast today is what I'll do in 18 holes on the golf course. I'll tell stories about Bryson. I'll tell them a recent interaction with John Rahm or Dustin Johnson or JT at the Players right. on Sunday, where I got to walk with him for 18 holes, walked with Colin Morikawa for 18 holes at the WGC in Bradenton, Florida a month ago. I'll tell all these stories in the next week ad nauseum to me, but that's what they want. And then there's days where they want me to say as little as possible. And you have to gauge that very quickly. And that's where some of the skill of caddying comes in, knowing what to do, when to do it, how much or how little to say. Playing the game is certainly helpful, especially for the amateurs. You right. know, most amateurs I find, and I don't understand this because I grew up, my parents had a beach house on the Gulf of Mexico, and I was given a left-handed 8-iron. And very similar to what Seve Ballesteros did, I went up and down the beach hitting 8-irons, soft sand, hard sand, off seaweed. I can hit any shot in the world off sand and with an 8-iron. I know how to do it. Amateurs are frightened by sand.
Right.
So usually by the second or third hole, I kind of see a major flaw or just basically lack of technique. And so I'll just give a quick little, hey, pros do this, try this, boom. Right. And, you know, and it's always fun for me when I can see somebody improve pretty quickly through the course of a round. And my joke is always, you know, when they hit a good one to a couple of feet, all I charge is $150 an hour. You can Venmo, PayPal, however you want to send it to me. We've been out here about 4 hours. You do the math. So that's always kind of a nice little punchline for me. But, you know, people ask, how do you go from caddying on tour and then caddying at the club? Is that just mind-numbingly boring to you? And I say, no, because it's different levels of success. Right. At the club, I can see incremental progress a lot quicker than you can on tour. On tour, there's the adrenaline, there's the money, there's the fans, there's the spotlight. And then at the club level, it's just helping somebody. And I like helping people. I'm in recovery. And before recovery, I was not a nice person. So maybe I'm trying to make up for lost right. time. And trying to turn over a new leaf and just trying to be of service more often. And even if that's in service being on the golf course, I feel like that's a way for me to help myself in recovery and help others. And I love the job of caddying because I am a believer in Jesus Christ. And so I try to be a servant in everything I do. And so I get to go out and I get to serve. I get to humble myself. And humility is not a trait that I was blessed with a lot of. So I have to work at that. So for me, I love the idea that I get to work at one of my weaknesses, going out every day and serving others in being a caddy. So for me, the job checks a lot of boxes, both personal growth and entertainment for me. Well, and that's why I love being a caddy.
Yeah, I mean, and those are really the boxes all of us should be trying to check, and many of us don't. Your sobriety, I think I would be taken away from it if I asked you about it. I think it's I'm familiar with what it takes, to do that. I'm proud of you, even though I really don't know you, but and you should be really proud of yourself. So I'm really happy for you.
Well, it's just one day at a time. Yep. And again, one of my lines is always, I'm just a recovering scumbag trying to do the next right thing.
Well, yeah. And
I did the wrong thing for a long time. And so I've got a long time of doing the right thing before I can level the ledger.
There you go. And just like golf, there are different ways of achieving that. You know, there's no really set key to it, just like there are different golf swings. So I have friends and family members who are doing the same things, and they all do it a little bit different. And that's fantastic. So congratulations on that. Coming back to the caddy thing, when we as fans and spectators get to watch these tournaments, whether it's on the PGA Tour or on the European Tour, with no spectators because of the coronavirus, a lot of the players are mic'd, a lot of the caddies are mic'd. I know John Rahm doesn't really like being mic'd. There was something on the TV the other day.
That Spanish flair, I think.
Well, I think it's, or where do you go? Arizona State, no? Is that where you went?
He did. He went to Arizona State.
He speaks better English than Spanish, I think. I don't know.
Well, when he got here, he didn't speak very much English.
Really?
So it shows you the growth as a human that he's had to make to adapt to life here in the States.
Yeah. He does have that fire, though. But listening to the conversations and the exchanges between players and caddy, and sometimes it's you can almost feel the silence, just like said, and you're like, now I know it's because there's nothing you can say to the guy to help him. But when you when you talk to your player, you talk. First of all, you talk about the first thing you look at is the lie of the ball. You know, you look at the shot, you got the distance, you got the wind, you got this, you got that, you got where you want to miss, where, you know, in case you miss, where you want to be. So it's really a whole bunch of information in a very short time that you go through with the player once he's, you know, whether he's, you know, still in the thinking box, before the playing box, however you want to define it, it doesn't matter. But there's really, you're almost part of the coaching team.
You wear a lot of different hats, from caddy to strategist to psychologist to trainer to meteorologist. I mean, you're looking at wind direction, velocity of wind, what's the temperature, where are we at elevation, where are we on the globe. There are different things that affect the ball, at different places. Even on the golf course, you can be on one tee box here and 300 yards below that, you're at another tee box. The ball is going to behave differently, both with the atmospheric conditions and also with elevation. So you need to understand that. And, but with, you know, you're always basically, the best caddies in the world are like great, great stockbrokers. They're great at assessing risk and understanding when to take a chance and when to play conservative. When the conservative play will help you. And there was some discussion of that this weekend, obviously, with match play. You're playing the golf course, yes, but you are playing an opponent as well. And so knowing what your opponent does well, what they don't do well, maybe your opponent hits it in the bunker and they're in the bottom half of the tour in sand save percentage. Well, that's an opportunity for a caddy. If he's done his homework and he knows what he's playing against in terms of stats for the opponent, that's where you say, hey, pro, let's not take the flag on here. Let's play fat side of the green. Let's just get it on there, put pressure on his sand game, which I don't think is very good. You're not maybe verbalizing all this, but it's just part of the thought process. But you do say, hey, let's bring this down at that shot link tower 5 yards left of the hole.
Right.
And he says, but the wind's blowing right to left. Yeah, I know. But if we happen to hit that thing at that target and the wind blows it, we're still left center of the green putting for birdie. He's going to have a hard time getting it up and down for a par. Right. I think we position ourselves there for maximum opportunity to minimize our risk, maximize our opportunity for success, and also put pressure on the opponent. So those are all things that you're floating around in your brain. And you're looking at these things in practice rounds. You're looking at these things when you walk the course without your pro. Okay, where are strengths and weaknesses? what, when we have an opponent that does this, what are we going to do? When we have an opponent that does this, what are we going to do? You're always, you know, football teams and soccer teams here in the United States, football for you guys, they're always watching film and they're always scouting the opponent. Well, we're doing the same thing. It's amazing. Our opponent all the time is the golf course. So we're scouting that. We're looking at how our strategy can match up against what the strategy of the golf course demands. Then you look at weather and how that's going to change your strategy. And then you look at your opponent and that also changes. So you're always adjusting. You're always making amendments to what you want to do and how you need to think. And I'm texting right now before we got on this, this podcast, I'm texting with a couple young ladies that just finished a round at the Augusta National Women's Amateur. And I'm kind of adjusting our game plan from what we had today to now going into tomorrow. The weather's going to change. The conditions are going to be much tougher. And based on what they did today, now the game plan changes going into tomorrow. Maybe the expectations are higher or lower than we first thought, depending on what they did. One player played really good. One player had a rough round. So how do I advise both those players with the current position they're in? Everything changes almost minute to minute at golf's highest level. And so you have to be able to adapt in the moment. And that's, again, being ADHD, we're bouncing all over the place anyway, mentally. So it's not really a stretch to have to shift gears in the middle of a professional event because our brains kind of do that naturally.
Yeah. But the fact that you guys, like, especially for the match play, you go out and hey, I'm playing Francesco Molinari. And then you go out and you're like, oh, he's not good in the sand. I mean, that to me, you know, you say you're scouting the opponent, which typically is the golf course, but in match play, it's also the guy you're playing against. So you're scouting him too.
And you're keeping stats throughout the round. Okay. You know, this guy's, he's had 5 8 footers. He's missed them all. So the best he's going to do coming out of this bunker is 8 to 10 feet. So there's the odds of him getting this up and down are very, very low. So let's not make a mistake and join him in the bunker. Let's give ourselves an advantage by playing more conservative. Or maybe you're playing a guy like Jason Day or Luke Donald, who's just an absolute wizard out of the sand. And when they hit it in the sand, they have a chance to hole it. So that's where you say, hey, I think we need to be a little bit more aggressive than we first thought. Right. Maybe you're on a par 5 and Luke hits first because he's a shorter hitter, but he hits it in the greenside bunker. And you're like, he's going to get that up and down. Right. He's going to make 4. 4 is only going to have the hole for us. If we need to win it, say it's 16 and we're 3 down with 3 to play and we have to win 16. We basically know we have to now get up and down from 240 yards to extend the match.
Right.
So again, everything changes based on what's going on and who you're playing and what their skill set is. So if Luke Donald's in a greenside bunker, 4 is not going to be any good for us. Yeah. We have to go for it. Even if we hit a bad shot, even if we don't physically execute it, the mental preparation says, the playbook says we have to go green light here. Right. So that, again, you're always looking at that stuff. And especially when it's coming down to the end of a match, yeah, you have maybe 13, 14, 15 holes of data that day, what this guy has done. Right. He has gotten up and down 6 for 6. You can expect he's going to get up and down 7 for 7. So right, let's not play too conservative and maybe lead to a 3-putt and we'll give him a hole, even though he missed the green. So right, you're always evaluating your position and relative to your opponent and what you're doing on the golf course.
You keep keeping live stats, by the way, you know, besides all the other stuff that you do already, which is amazing. Of course, you know, and when I started getting into golf on TV, you know, they were the first caddy superstars. I mean, it's, you know, it started with Herman Mitchell, with Lee Trevino's caddy, who was, you know, a rock star. Tom Watson's caddy, Bruce Edwards. Who was the other guy that Tiger got, that guy with the mustache?
Fluff.
Yeah,
Mike Cowan.
Yeah. And then he changed to that guy from New Zealand, who was everybody.
Steve Williams.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like a little bit of a heart of bones and things like this. So the caddy is, you know, started becoming something, you know, not sexy, but it was like, you know, they were characters. People understood what they did. You know,
been a push the last, I'd say, 3 to 4 years on social media. Social media has really helped bring these caddies in. There's now these channels called the Caddy Network, and there's all these different features on caddies, and there's a lot more attention being paid to them. And it's kind of to me, it's natural that they would get the attention they get because it's the only job across sport where somebody other than the athlete is on the playing surface with the athletes. In soccer, the coaches are on the sideline. Basketball, coaches are on the sideline. Baseball, they're in the dugout. Football, they're on the sideline. Golf, there's somebody other than the competitor on the turf, on the playing surface at all times, assisting the player. Nobody's standing with LeBron James on the free throw line telling him where he needs to aim the shot. Right. Nobody is with Cristiano Ronaldo when he's on a penalty kick telling him which way to curve the ball. He's on his own out there. The coach cannot be present. So right. Golf is the only sport where there's someone other than the competitor that's directly involved in the outcome and is right there on the playing surface. So it's kind of, to me, a natural progression that caddies would begin to get a little bit more attention for what they do. And again, no, we've never hit a shot at the professional level, but we do influence outcomes sometimes negatively, but we do influence it. So the fact that caddies are getting more attention is, to me, kind of a no-brainer, because for me, being in the profession this entire century, which makes me sound really old, but I've been paying attention to caddies for 20, 25 years.
Right. And then, you know, what's fascinating, you know, then you have not only this, and you talk about information and knowledge and experience, and you have the chemistry with the player. I mean, Lee Westwood is going out with his girlfriend. I don't think she's keeping live stats of how many times the guy, you know. So there has to be, and I, you know, from the way you were talking at the beginning, this kind of scientific approach with all the different things, the wind speed and this. I'm obviously leading up to your matchup with Bryson at the 2016 Masters, I believe it was.
5 years ago now.
Yeah, 5 years ago. And you know what? I looked that up. Well, number one, I think he got into the Masters because he was the U.S. Open champion, the U.S. amateur champion.
U.S. amateur champion.
Which means that.
And that's where we met. We met in Chicago Wednesday of that week.
Right.
I was actually working for Grant Forrest, who's on the European tour, kid from Scotland, very talented young man.
Remember
starting
that,
yeah. to become a little bit more of a regular presence on the European tour. And thanks to my advice, he had missed match play. I talked him into an 8-iron, should have been a 9-iron. We flew it over the green, didn't make birdie on the 36th hole, so did not make match play. I was packing my car, driving from Chicago back home to Atlanta. I was actually, 1 foot was in the car already. I was getting ready to close the door. Bryson came walking by. We had met earlier in the week at a barbecue. And I said, "Hey, what's going on?" He said, "Just found out time of my match, getting ready to go later today." I said, "Okay, well, what's your plan?" And he said, "Short of a victory here, I'll turn pro right after the Walker Cup." And I said, "Do you have a caddy?" He said, "No." I said, "Do you want my number?" He said, "Yes." And that's how we met.
Wow.
And that's how we began our relationship. And sure enough, I drive home to Atlanta, and 4 days later, he's the U.S. amateur champion. I'm like, boy, I'm glad I gave that kid my number.
Well, he smoked whoever he was playing. I remember like 7 or 6 or something like that at in the finals.
Eric Bard, I think he beat him 6-5.
Something like that, yeah. Like in Olympia Fields, another great golf course. But then, well, Bryson, you know, everybody was talking about, and obviously, you know, I personally, I'm interested in some of these. Super, maybe not so deep questions as well. You know, everybody thought he was going to win last year. You know, he went talking about the 48 inch driver, whatever the thing is. But so he finished tied for 34th. He finished last 2020. 2019, he finished tied for 29th. Okay. 2018, he finished tied for 38th. 2017, he didn't play. 2016, when you were on the bag, he had his highest finish at Augusta, tied for 21st, low amateur. So if he doesn't finish in the top 21 this year, I think you might have the job back.
No, I don't. Tim Tucker is the current caddy. He does a fantastic job.
Right.
You know, we split up, and it wasn't a friendly split when we split, but I was actually at Winged Foot last year. I was assigned that group on Sunday with Bones. So I'm walking on Sunday watching my former boss with the guy who replaced me win a major championship. And I'm standing in the middle of the 18th fairway as they're walking up the green. And I just stood there with my arms crossed, took it all in. And I said, you know, the right guy is carrying that bag up that hill. Tim is great for Bryson. He allows Bryson to be who he needs to be. Tim is a very patient man. He's firm when he needs to be, but he's a great sounding board for Bryson. No matter what they finish at Augusta, the job is Tim's. Tim is doing a fantastic job. I believe they are approaching 10 wins together worldwide. So no shame in the job he's doing, despite not getting higher results at Augusta. And I think that has a lot to do with the guy swinging the club, not the guy carrying the bag, both his good result and his bad results.
Yeah, it was a poor attempt at German humor. I'd be here all the week. I didn't mean that at all, but I just found it interesting that his lowest round was there as an amateur. And to fill the folks in, when you said you were there at Wingfoot in the 18th fairway with Bones, and Bones is obviously Bones Mackay, Phil Mickelson's former caddy. You are now working for NBC and the Golf Channel on a pretty regular basis, where you're in the fairway following these groups. Tell us a little about your work that you're doing there.
My quick line for everybody, when they see me come up and I duck inside the ropes and fans say, what are you doing? What's your role? And I basically say, I'm Bones's caddy. I'm the caddy for the caddy. I get the numbers and I'm the link in the chain between the actual caddying for the guys, and Bones, who has to stay 40, 50 yards away simply so he doesn't disturb the players while he's giving his commentary. He needs to be present and close, but he can't be so close where he's a distraction. So I am his eyes and ears right there next to the players and the caddies. I am listening to everything they're saying, trying to pick up something. It may be a player's ball rolls in a divot, and it's just with the rush of getting up to the hitting area, Bones can't get over and see that the ball's in a divot, as was the case on Sunday at the match play, the fifth fairway. Scottie Scheffler hit it in a sand-filled divot. It was on the left side of the fairway. Bones walked up the right side. I could tell he wasn't going to get over and see it, so I made a note, and I gave it to him. He was able to then tell the producer. The producer and the director were able to get a camera down and show the sand-filled divot around the ball. And so I'm just kind of the eyes and ears, not just for Bones, but for our producers and directors, and also basically a bit of a stage director for our camera guys, our mic techs, making sure everybody's in the right spot, making sure shadows aren't being cast over a player or a caddy, trying to, maybe knock down some ropes if I'm ahead and I know the ropes need to be moved. I'm trying to just make things happen as quick as possible for pace of play purposes, and also just for the well-being of the players and the caddies. I'm just trying to look out for everybody and make sure everybody's doing their job with as little distraction as possible. And I'm basically, when there's threesomes, I'm a fourth caddy in the group. And when there's twosomes, I'm a third caddy. So if there's a situation where a guy is last to hit and his ball misses the green, I can jump in and rake the bunker in a way where the player won't get a penalty, where he won't get fined. The groups behind won't complain about the state of the sand. And the guys out there, I've worked with a lot of these caddies, and they know me and they trust me enough to leave that bunker unattended, trust that I'll get it, and they can move on. You know, Michael Greller can run with Jordan up the fairway, and he can trust that I'm going to get it in a way that would be acceptable to him. Right. And I try to even do a better job in this role raking the bunkers than I would maybe if I was caddying, because in caddying, I am trying to get up to the green to help my player. Whereas in this role, I have some time. I'm not going to be around the greens. So I've got time to get the bunker, then get to the next landing zone. Yeah. So again, I'm just trying to help the guys as much as possible. In some cases, I might be the one to tell the guys who's away. Again, just trying to speed things up. And my next event will be the Walker Cup. Okay. At Seminole Golf Club in first weekend of May. Great golf. And then after that, I'll be at the U.S. Open at Torrey Pines. I'll do the Women's PGA Championship here in Atlanta. I'll be in Tokyo for both weeks of the Olympics. I'll be at the Ryder Cup, a couple of playoff events. So I'll be out there running around. I make it a point not to get in the camera shot. So if you see me, I'm not doing my job as best
I've
I
seen
can.
You. I've seen you once. even in Germany. But I was just going to say, you know, it's got to be a tremendous asset that the caddies and probably most of the players know you and Bones, and that they can go about their business without having to worry about you know, some guy distracting them. So
and they trust us too. If we, you know, there was a situation with Scottie Scheffler and John Rahm where they were both very, very close to the hole on the fringe. And as they walked up to the green, John looked at me and said, "Who is it?" And I pointed at John. He didn't question it. Right. He walked up and Scottie said, "Who is it?" And John said, "It's me." So I'm able just to kind of help the process, help the speed of play. And I'm also using this. I'm courting some young players, some collegiate players, some amateur golfers who are very, very accomplished and hopefully will get some opportunities at the PGA level. And so in the interim, before I actually get these jobs as a professional caddy, I'm getting great experience. I am listening in. You know, when Dustin and Austin Johnson are talking about shots in the fairway, I'm listening to how Austin's presenting this information. When Billy Foster and Matt Fitzpatrick are talking about a shot, I'm listening to Billy. You know, Billy caddy for Seve Ballesteros. Nice. Every chance you can get to be around somebody like that, that's a good thing. And for me as a professional, there's no negative, no downside to me listening to Billy Foster in the moment give his guy information. I can pick something up from that. And you do it enough. You know, Michael Greller. I learned from Michael Greller. I learned from all these guys. Mick Daugherty, who's now with Tyrrell Hatton. I'm listening to him give information. Gareth Lord, who was with Henrik Stenson when he won the Open Championship. Now he's with Matt Wallace. I was with those guys last week listening to Gareth. Right. Give Matt information. I am trying to soak up and be a sponge to these current caddy legends. Right. And hopefully I can use that information to help a young golfer. I may not have the on the bag experience the last couple of years like other guys have, but boy, every time I'm working with NBC, I'm watching how tournaments are won and lost right before my eyes. Right. I'm listening to the information, good or bad, that's being given. And I can make my own assessment and filter in and out what is good and bad and pass that down once I get another opportunity to caddy for somebody of the stature like Bryson.
Right. Exactly. When you were caddy, or, you know, even now, is there camaraderie among the caddies? I mean, you guys are, you know, you guys like a traveling group, you know?
I mean, I've always called it a floating high school.
Right.
It's a floating grade school. I mean, it's the same people, and it's a little bit surreal sometimes. You will be even in one country. You know, you'll be in Santiago, Chile, and you'll leave a golf course and there will be players on putting greens and on driving ranges, and you will get on an airplane and fly to Brazil. And when you get to the golf course in Brazil, those same players you saw in Chile on the putting green and driving ranges have already beaten you to the property, and you feel like you made pretty good time. You didn't waste too much time or take a nap at the hotel. Right. And they're already at the property, and you're like, how did that happen? So it's really strange to go time zones, countries, across oceans. Right. And when you get there, the same group of people are exactly in the same spot they were the last place you left. And, you know, we will go from Scotland, from Royal St. George, to the Olympics in Tokyo. And then I will leave Tokyo and I will go to Oakmont for the U.S. Amateur. And there will be a lot of the same people in all three of those spots.
So you got to get along.
You got, and it's not just the caddies, it's the players, it's the equipment reps, it's the officials, it's the agents, it's the wives and girlfriends, it's the moms and dads. Scottie Scheffler's dad and I were heckling each other all weekend because I was with the Scottie group three or four of the matches. And so by Sunday, when Scottie was down two holes, I think with five to play, I saw his mother and I said, "Where's your husband? I bet he's a nervous wreck." And he kind of waved. He said, "I see ya." So again, you just get to know everybody in the game. It's a very small community. You know, we watch it on TV and we see these different guys in South Africa or in Abu Dhabi. And then we see guys in San Diego playing, and it's hard to believe, but we're all part of the same family. We're just in a different place doing our job that particular week. But at certain points, we all come together and we all interact. And at the lower levels of the game, at the mini tours, at the challenge tour in Europe, Korn Ferry here in the United States, a lot of the same guys are bouncing around. The same caddies are coming and going with different players. The same cliques that exist right. on the Challenge Tour, they exist 5 years later on the European Tour when all those guys have graduated up. And so it's just like any other sport. The guys that you're around at your formative levels, those are the guys that you stay with. I mean, Lee Westwood is still friends 20 years later with all the guys he was with when he was trying to get his card on the European Tour. And those guys are all still friends of his, and he still keeps up with them. And the Aussies are just a whole clique. All the Aussie golfers, they're all friends. I was walking around with Cam Smith at the Players and Aaron Price, who's now selling real estate in Florida, a former pro golfer that I know who's an Australian, was following Cam around. And Aaron got in the cart with me and we rode a couple holes and just caught up like old friends. It's a small world, pro golf. And so, yeah, we all get to know each other. It is a bit of a traveling band of gypsies, and we have stories. And it's funny. You'll do something one day and 10 years later, there's still people teasing you about it. So if you don't like a nickname or something, or if you did something you're not proud of, it's probably going to stick with you.
There you go. Yeah, you mentioned, you know, all the people that are around, from the agents and the equipment reps and you know, girlfriends, wives, parents. I saw some footage of you and your parents at Augusta when you cared for Bryson. That was some powerful stuff. That was that was really cool. And then, you know, you have this a podcast yourself, which is called My Side of the Bag, and you also on your social media channels you share a lot of stuff from your yardage books and things like this. I remember the first professional golf event I went to as a spectator was, I think it was the 84, whenever the Open was in St. Andrews, when Seve won, 84, 85. Obviously, you know, I was a tennis player first, you know, and then Bernhard Langer obviously got a lot of Germans my age into the sport. And I remember watching him, or following him in the practice round. It was 85, and you know, in St. Andrews, there were like, I don't know, 200 people in a practice round. It wasn't like today with his 10,000, 20,000 people for a practice. And he's walking around with this measuring wheel. You know, he himself, he's like walking the whole course with this thing. There's a wheel in the front, taking notes and things like this. You guys obviously have access to different technology. You got the lasers, this, that. You know, I've seen, you know, the stuff you put online of, you know, from your yardage books. How much of this stuff do you have?
Well, I mean, we're doing a Zoom call, which, you know, I know you won't see in the audio, but there's the third green at Augusta National.
Well, I can't wait.
There's my notes.
I can't wait for your Augusta notes. But this goes back to, I guess, from when you, just like the player keeps notes. Do you keep yardage book? Do the players keep their own? Do you compare? How does that work?
We always compare notes, and we always do keep yardage books that are applicable for tournaments we're going to play in the future. Right. But I have probably about 5 or 6 shoeboxes, big shoeboxes full of yardage books from 2002 all the way to the one I used last week in Austin. I'm using, you know, Champions Retreat yardage book for the women's amateur. And then Saturday they will play at Augusta, and I have that yardage book. And of course, next week, the guys will be playing at Augusta, and I'll be posting stuff out of this very book that I used in 2016. It's still applicable for all but number 5. Okay. 5 has changed since I worked there, so I won't say too much about number 5 because I don't have that inside knowledge. But the other 17 holes, they're all right here in my hand, and
it's awesome stuff.
If somebody wants to hire me, then they've got 17 holes of something that the folks at Augusta say doesn't exist, which is a contour map.
Okay.
I am actually one of the last people to have a contour map. One of my close friends qualified for the Masters with his player, Andrew Landry, in 2017. I worked for Bryson in 2016. I walked around, created these contour maps with a digital green reading device. They sat my friend down as soon as he entered the property ahead of the tournament, I think in February. And they said no digital green reading devices are allowed at Augusta. So I have the last digital contour map created at Augusta. So if anybody out there is watching this podcast and you want a digital green reading contour right. map, I'm your guy.
And I'll be your caddy. I'll carry that for you to some people.
Well, one of the big reasons Bryson was T21 that year in 2016, he was 45 of 45 putts 5 feet and in. He did not miss one. And a big part of that was the mapping and the pre-tournament work we did. We got every hole location from the previous 5 years, found the straight putt from 5 feet and in, and we didn't miss one all week.
Right.
So that was a big secret to success. Why I haven't been invited back to work there is a question to me.
Well, maybe some young German guy that'll qualify. This is the guy I need. Do the European players, just as a side note, do the European players usually have European caddies? Can you see? Because the insight you guys have, well, I mean, I guess they're also over on those golf courses, but you don't just put those books over together overnight.
No, you don't. You do see a lot of Euro to Euro hiring. The only Yank that will be in the European team room that I know of is Adam Hayes, who caddies for John Rahm. Okay. Billy Foster with Matt Fitzpatrick. Gareth Lord with Matt Wallace. You get a lot of those guys. And again, a lot of these guys, you know, Mark Fulcher, who we call Fooch, was on the bag last week for Paul Casey. He was famously on the bag for many years for Justin Rose. I think he's worked 15, 16 Masters. So a lot of these guys, they have a ton of experience, even more so than I do, being such a local. That's the Europeans. They will recycle a lot of the same guys. You know, Billy Foster now on the back for Matt Fitzpatrick, caddied there for Lee Westwood for many years, and before that, Seve Ballesteros. So, you know, Billy Foster, I think the top European caddy in terms of success, been in the final round of every major with Lee Westwood, worked multiple Ryder Cups. There's other guys like Craig Conley. We call him Wee Man.
Yeah.
Won majors with Martin Keimer and was on Paul Casey's bag for a long time. John McLaren, Paul Casey's main guy. All of these guys, great European caddies who I have a ton of respect for, and I've tried to learn as much as I can when I'm around those guys. So, yeah, they've got just as much experience as a lot of these Americans, in some cases more so.
Right. Yeah, and it's just a fascinating thing. Let's talk Augusta, okay? Number one, it's just the most awesome place. I mean, you know, I've never been there, but it's just everything about it is just special, let me put it that way. You might not agree with everything, you know, the lakes are too blue and the grass is too green, whatever, especially when they did it in November, whenever that was. But it's the mysticism around the place, you know, and it to me, as an outsider, as an observer, as you know, nobody that, you know, I really have no idea. It starts with the results. You know, no first timers win except Fuzzy. Nobody that's won the par three contest wins. You know, those kind of things alone are to me, you know, something. Whoa, what's going on here? I did listen to one of your podcasts from the Masters, and you were talking about, which I didn't know, how the tee sheets were made. How the pairings were made, that former champions never play together. Can you talk a little bit about that? I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, each former champion gets their own group, so to speak. So Bernhard Langer will never play first two rounds with Bubba Watson. They're both former champs. They will get their own pairing. They will always tee off first in that pairing both days on the first tee. And as they approach every green, the patrons, they know who the past champions are, and every green, every tee box they approach, you usually will see it on the coverage when they're walking from 11 green up the hill to the 12th tee, everybody will stand and applaud the former champion. And, it's just a neat tradition, in a place full of tradition. Some will get a little sick of the tradition, especially by Sunday afternoon, but, it's what makes it so special. For me, as somebody who grew up watching it just down the road, even though I wasn't into golf, it was a local sporting event for us, which people, I always find it funny that people come from all over the world to this event. And this is a local event for us. And it's a global event for everyone else. And it's just another local sporting event for us. It's like a college football game on a fall Saturday. You know, the second weekend in April, we're going to have a golf tournament down I-20 off Washington Road.
Right.
And some people think that's just hilarious, but I grew up watching this event and now I've taken part in the event. And it is just the relationships you make with the members. I was emailing a member this morning, hey, have a great week. If you see this person, tell them I said hello.
Right.
And maybe, you know, try to offer this person some assistance. They're new there. They've never been around. They could probably use a little guidance, you know, just things like that. And, right. I know 10 members personally. And so a lot of that comes from my experience there in 2016 with Bryson, a lot of these members that I have cultivated these relationships with, and they reach out to me. And when they come through Atlanta, or some of them that live here in Atlanta, we always talk about it. Every time we see each other, they never get tired of it, the members, and I never get tired of talking about it. And it's kind of neat when I meet these members, they'll give me stuff they may not give other people because they know I understand. I have this intimate knowledge. So for me to be in that place now in my life where members actually tell me stuff that maybe other folks in the general public never hear, I find it fascinating. And they know I would never share certain things on my podcast or to anyone else about the goings on of the club. But it's fun to have that relationship with these guys. And that's the thing you take with you. And, you know, people don't understand how cool it is to be there in the caddy shack in the mornings. Most of the time, caddies aren't treated as well as the players are. There's usually a drop off from the way the players are treated, the way the caddies are treated. At Augusta, the caddy shack, which is off to the side of the practice facility that everybody sees on all the pre-tournament coverage, there's two head pros at Augusta. And every morning I was there, both head pros had breakfast in the caddy shack with us. Wayne Gretzky sat at my table one morning for breakfast. Jay Haas, whose son Bill Haas was competing in that event, he was in there eating breakfast with us one morning. It's just so neat, the people that are just kind of floating around and the people that you end up meeting. And there's and there was a situation where Bryson and I were playing a hole about a month ahead of the tournament. And there was a member on an adjacent hole. And I said, hey, this is one of the members I know. I really want to introduce you to this guy. And the member had a global celebrity as his guest, a very recognizable celebrity who will remain nameless. And I walk Bryson over and we meet and I introduce him to the member. I introduce the member to Bryson. The celebrity's kind of standing there just expecting to be introduced.
Can I take one guess?
No, I'm not going to reveal the name.
Bill Murray.
That's part of the deal at Augusta. You can't talk about too much what you see there. This global celebrity is just assuming they're going to become part of this conversation soon. I chat with the member and with Bryson, and then we say goodbye to the member and we walk away. And as we're walking up to the green, Bryson says, was that? I said, yeah. But here at Augusta, the members are the celebrities. And we never said a word to that celebrity. And the next day, the celebrity's still on property. And at that point, the celebrity comes over and introduces themselves to us.
Wow.
And that's kind of how it goes at Augusta. You don't want to, they're not there to be interviewed.
Right.
You leave them alone. If they want to approach you, that's great. And then we're on the putting green on Sunday night after playing 18 holes with Ben Crenshaw the Sunday before the tournament. We go 18 with Mr. Crenshaw. Fascinating to watch Bryson and his scientific approach bait and talk about putting with Ben Crenshaw, who is maybe the ultimate field putter of all time.
Yeah.
Fascinating to hear that conversation, which I actually shared a little bit with Bones last weekend. We were in Austin, Texas, and Mr. Crenshaw comes walking by our cart, walking by himself. And I say, Mr. Crenshaw, and he turns, he goes, hey guys. And I said, I want you to tell Bones about the conversation you and Bryson had on the 10th green at Augusta when he pulled out his putting chart. He starts telling Bones this story. Bones has fallen out of the cart. This is a guy in Bones who's won the Masters three times, and Crenshaw told him a story he's never heard.
Wow.
And it's just kind of neat, the fabric of the event, how we all have our different experiences. But we're on the putting green after going 18 with Mr. Crenshaw. And all of a sudden, we watch Jack Nicklaus and his son come off 18 green. There's no one but Jack and his sons, their caddies, and me and Bryson in view. Nobody else on the property.
Yeah.
Right behind them, Gary Player and his son come off 18 green. Then we look out and we see Bubba Watson and his wife and two members, a male and Condoleezza Rice, coming up the ninth green. We expect them as everybody's done, to walk into the clubhouse, except Condoleezza Rice is making a beeline at us. And Bryson says, I think she's coming over here to talk to us. I said, I think she She comes a little closer. He goes, what do I say? I said, I'd start with hello, Madam Secretary, and let her drive the bus from there. And that's kind of just the experiences you get at Augusta. And I haven't even talked about any of the holes we played in the tournament yet.
Right.
It's just being around the members, being at such a special place. Bryson one day in February was practicing on the members range, which is on the side of Washington Road. And he said, I'm good for a while. Why don't you just go and explore? And I walked up and down Magnolia Lane as many times until Bryson was done practicing, probably about 20 times. I walked up and down that road all by myself, just soaking it in.
Yeah.
And I was the only one on the road. Security left me alone. And I'm just walking up and down all 53 Magnolias.
Wow.
All by myself for probably an hour, just enjoying being there on that road all by myself. And it's things like that that you take with you. The tournament is great. The tournament you can go back and watch on video. But the things that you do by yourself when no one's around, that's the special stuff. Mm. That's the neat stuff. And one more story.
Sure.
The sommelier, the wine steward, takes us down in the wine cellar, down an elevator. Who knows how far underneath the surface of the earth we went to this wine cellar. You feel like you're in a James Bond film sometimes when you're at Augusta. And we go down and he shows us all these different wines. And one neat thing about Augusta that many people don't know, whatever they buy the wine for at market price that day, no matter when they sell it, whether it's a year or 30 years later, that's what you pay for it.
Wow.
So if you order a wine that was bought in 1984, you're paying 1984 market price for that bottle of wine.
That's showing us
all these different champagnes from France and telling us how much it would cost you to drink that today. And in some cases, it's staggering how inexpensive it is to drink these very, very fine wines that in any other restaurant in the world would probably be 100 times that. And then all of a sudden he walks us to this rickety shelf and it looks like it just a good jolt from the air conditioning unit would knock this thing over. And there's this scribbled writing on the front of each shelf and it's Clifford Roberts' own writing. And it says Mr. Roberts wine on the top shelf. And then right below that, it says President Eisenhower's wine. And there's one bottle there, dust all over it. The sommelier takes it off the shelf, goes to hand it to me. It's the last bottle of President Dwight Eisenhower's wine that's still at Augusta. And I looked at the sommelier, I looked at Bryson, I said, no way am I grabbing that bottle of wine. I'm not going to be the guy that drops that bottle and eliminates the stash of an American president. He goes, no, go ahead. And I mean, it was, and people joke, you know, what was the most nervous you ever got in that Masters? It was holding that bottle of wine. Had nothing to do with the golf course or pulling a club on number 12 when all four directions of wind are hitting you. It's holding that darn bottle of wine. That was where I was scared to death. And I get the wine. I quickly and safely hand it back and I'm done. I've held it and it's over. And then right below that, he says, these are the three bottles of wine, Spanish wines that were Seve's favorite three wines that Phil served at the champions dinner right before Seve's death in honor of him. Wow. And so that is still right now, as we sit here, those three bottles are on that shelf right below President Eisenhower's wine. Think of all the champions dinners that have been held and they saved those three bottles because Seve was that special to Augusta. And my uncle has an autograph from, I think, 1979. And it says Severiano Ballesteros.
Wow.
Once he won the Masters, he never signed anything that way ever again. It was Seve Ballesteros. So if you get the full name on an autograph, kind of a rare thing. And he got that. My uncle got that at Augusta. So all these different things, these tapestries that are interwoven in your experience at Augusta and in your own personal life is what makes that place so special. Right. And Frank, I would love to facilitate in some way getting you to Augusta for the Masters in one of these next few years. It is a special place. Great. I won't do you the dishonor of me showing you around because I actually want you to enjoy it. I don't want to talk your ear off the whole way. I showed my sister around her first trip, I think in 2006. And my dad asked her in the car on the way back down the interstate, well, Katie, did you enjoy it? And she says, yes. Well, walking around with Drew, I got the complete tour. So I don't want to ruin your experiences with all my my stories. I want you to experience it for yourself.
Oh, that was super. And Bryson obviously got to stay in the Crow's Nest as the amateur champion.
He did. Year. We had a house for the week for himself, me,
you stayed and on his the coach.
Well, no, we had a house in Augusta near the golf course that he stayed in every night but Monday night.
Okay.
So Monday morning, we're in the house, and he says, I'm going to stay tonight in the Crow's Nest to get the experience, but the rest of the week, I'm here to win. I want to stay in the house. Okay.
He came to win.
Monday afternoon, we're on the range, and we decide to leave, and it's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There's no reentry on any gate, even my gate, the caddy gate, after 4 p.m. I go out of the gate, and suddenly, as soon as I walk out, the agent says, Bryson does not have his pants for the amateur dinner with the chairman tonight. You have to go to the house, get the pants, and take them to him in the Crow's Nest. So, I mean, we got Masters traffic, right? So I go to the house. I get the pants. They're wrinkled. He didn't iron his pants. The man doesn't miss a detail except when it comes to his own wardrobe sometimes. So I don't know how I did this, but I talked my way through security at the caddy gate at about 5:55. The amateur dinner starts at 6 p.m. sharp. This is during the days of Chairman Billy Payne, who ruled, some say, with an iron fist. You don't make the chairman wait for anything. It's 5:55. I get back in the gate, and I'm sprinting across the members' driving range alongside Magnolia Lane.
With the pants under your arm.
With the pants, and I'm running as fast as I can. They said there was a cart coming to get me. I wasn't going to wait. I took off. I get to the front door of the clubhouse. I tell the lady at the front desk, I need to take these to Bryson. She said, I think he's in the Crow's Nest. I run as fast as I can up 2 flights of stairs, through that skinny little stairwell, drop them on the table in the Crow's Nest, run back down. As soon as I get down, I see the head pro. He says, where are the pants? I said, I just dropped them off. He said, the chairman is waiting. He is not happy. I said, I'm so sorry. And at that point, my job is done, but I think I need to probably leave the premises since who knows? I'm walking back across the members' driving range, and 3 guards with weapons drawn approach me. And they say, young man, we have talked to the clubhouse. We understand why you were doing what you were doing. Let me assure you, you never need to do that again. You were in the crosshairs of 3 weapons.
Wow.
And I said, thank you for letting me off easy. And I left and I went home and I took a deep breath. I will never, ever try to run like that across the grounds of Augusta National after closing time ever again.
Wow. Those are some unbelievable stories. I mean, that's just incredible, incredible.
And again, Frank, we hadn't even talked about the tournament yet.
Exactly. One more question about that before we get to that. How early before the event do you get to go and practice there?
Once you earn your invitation, you're free to come.
Okay.
As a professional, pretty much as often as you want.
Okay.
There was an amateur who will remain unnamed, who changed the rules for amateurs a few years ago. They overstayed their welcome a little bit and didn't show the hospitality or the courtesies, I should say, that you should show when being a guest. So they changed some of the rules for the amateurs. Now you can make 5 trips, up to 3 days for each trip, and you can bring 1 guest every time you come. So most amateurs will make their trip with their father or their coach. And then the last few trips, you'll bring your caddy in.
Right.
Bryson made 1 trip with his coach. And then I made the other trips with him just to get the golf course down.
Right.
And so we had been around the golf course probably upwards of 15 times before we even showed up for the tournament. And another thing many folks may not know, as his caddy, I'm not allowed to carry his bag until Saturday before the tournament. So every time we went, an Augusta National caddy was carrying his bag, and I'm just walking around, just enjoying being there.
Wow.
Now, obviously, working for Bryson, there's always a task. So I always had things to do. I had my yardage book, and we were filling it up with information, as we've previously discussed. But I didn't carry the bag until Saturday before the tournament. So before that even happens, we've been around 15, 20 times. And then, so people ask, were you nervous on that first tee on Thursday? And I always say, not really, because by that point, we had been around a couple dozen times and we were rip-roaring ready to go.
Right. There you go. Let's talk about the golf course. What makes it so special? I mean, it's we had some very interesting discussions with Ron Pritchard, with the architect, and with David Ogren, who played in the Masters. And just like most of the golf, what makes good golf courses today is the greens and the undulations in the greens. That's what the defense, or you know, even in the days of length, and because there's no rough and things like this, it is the greens. But what makes, other than the outside factors of everything we just talked about, of the green jacket, of the history, of Bobby Jones, of you know, the place that it is, of trying to win that, even to try win a major, you know, even if it's not your first one, but the golf course itself, you know, is it a second shot? How would you describe it? Is it a second shot golf course? I'm trying to sound like a caddy.
Part of it, you know, Bobby Jones and Alistair McKenzie wanted it to be an homage to St. Andrews. They wanted to give you options, both on the ground and in the air, just like you were presented with at St. Andrews. And in a lot of ways, that still exists. There are some ways that many have complained that's been taken away. The trees down the right of 11, the addition of trees between 15 and 17, that now you don't get the moguls and the speed slot there you used to get 20 years ago. A lot of the Tiger proofing has taken some of the options and the wide angles and multiple angles of play away. But there's still many, many ways to skin the cat on just about every hole there. Two is a great example. You can try to rip one around the corner and turn it down right to left off that fairway bunker and get it down as far as you want to create a shorter shot. I've seen Dustin Johnson on number two have as short as 160 yards into a back left pin, which is the longest the hole will play. I've seen Jordan Spieth hit three wood onto the green. The 3 wood off the tee takes the bunker down the right out of play as far as being too long. So all different ways to play every hole based on what you want to do, how you want to attack the hole. That's one thing that makes it special. The scale of the slope. It's indescribable to someone who's never been there. The mounding, the elevation changes on every single hole. When you get there, the first thing that's going to take your breath away is the uphill and downhill. It is on the side of a western facing slope. The clubhouse is at the top on the eastern end of the property, and Ray's Creek and the tributary of Ray's Creek down at 13, they're on the far western edge of the property, and it's just a gentle slope all the way down. And it's, you know, 100, 150 feet from the top to the bottom of the property, and you're going up and down it throughout the course of the round from, you know, the tee shot on 8 going up the hill, then back down to the gully on 9. There's the scale of the place. It's just impossible to duplicate, and it's impossible for TV to truly do it justice. They are trying to create more 4D cameras, and maybe with some drone footage this year, you'll see some different shots. I remember seeing some drone footage last year that gives you an idea of maybe the scale of the place, but until you see it for yourself, it's hard to explain. The other thing that makes it so unique is nobody is allowed to tee off on Wednesday past 1 o'clock. At 3 o'clock, on Wednesday afternoon, everybody has to be off the golf course. It's not get a 2:50 tee time and sneak out before they shut down the tee. Right. At 3 o'clock, they will remove you from the golf course. So from 3 in the afternoon, and basically nobody really tees off after 1 o'clock. So the first green from about 1:15 on Wednesday afternoon to right around 8:30 on Thursday morning, that's when they have a chance to manipulate it, change it, do whatever they want to it. And the first thing you notice, because everybody usually goes off number one, you will walk on the green on Wednesday, and then it's a severe 7-8% slope, the front of that first green. And when you step on it on Thursday morning, it's like you've stepped on a New York City sidewalk, and it will psych you out. It's amazing how fast that place can change. It's the only golf course I know that can do that. It can scare the players simply by taking a step on the putting surface.
Wow.
You take a step and it jars your lower leg because it's so firm and so hard. And that affects and influences your decision making the rest of the day. It's so amazing how they do it. And we all know it's coming. You hear about it if you're a first timer. And then when you experience it, and even veterans, they'll step on that first green and they say, you never get used to that first step. It scares the daylights out of you as soon as you hit it. And by the time you get up in the middle of that green and you're marking your ball, if you've hit the green, you're already thinking, how much do we need to adjust for speed? And so if anybody ever makes a 20-footer for birdie on the first hole, you have no idea at home the mental gymnastics it took to get that ball in the hole, because you know they were scared to death, not really sure, am I judging this speed correctly? Is it going to be 4 feet short, or am I going to zoom this 7 feet by and have a three putt right out of the gate? It is a real fear the players face on that green. It's the only golf course I know that scares the players from the very start of the round. The first hole is always one of the top six toughest holes on the golf course. And then that first green, New York City sidewalk that it is, it will throw so many demons into your head. And everybody saw the Ernie Els six putt, seven putt, whatever it was in 2016.
Yep.
And nobody's ever going to forget that. Right, it is that in the back of their minds. There is so much fear you have to overcome on that golf course from the word go. And it makes it so much fun to caddy, because you really earn your stripes that week. And it's the only golf course I've ever worked. I've had many rounds where my guy finishes on a hot streak, 3-4 birdies or whatever. Bryson was, I think, 3 under par standing on the 18th tee on Friday. And when you're in a situation like that and your guy's just striping it, it's a laser light show. You almost say, man, I wish I could just go from 18 green to the first tee and just keep playing the next round. Not once do you say that at Augusta. You are so mentally spent, emotionally, mentally, physically spent, because it's such a hard walk. You get to the back of the 18th green and you take a deep breath and you go, I am so glad I have 15 hours until I have to do this again.
Right.
And basically you go home at night and you don't talk to anybody. You don't say anything. You may watch a little bit of the coverage, but you really are just trying to not think. Because it actually gives you a headache thinking so much. And by the end of that tournament, the guys that have won it, they look exhausted, and rightfully so, because it is such hard work, 72 holes on that golf course, and you're just beat up. The fact that anybody can play the Masters and contend and then go play the next week in Hilton Head, which is what Bryson and I did, and he finished fourth in Hilton Head. And to me, that may be one of the greatest accomplishments in his career. That he contended at Augusta and then was the leader in the clubhouse on Sunday night at Harbortown, because mentally Augusta just zaps you, everything in you it takes to get around 18 holes there. And that's what makes it so special. And that's why it's almost burned into all of our memories, because it takes so much effort, every single shot, every single decision, that you remember it the rest of your life. I can tell you exactly what was said at certain points on the golf course throughout the tournament. I can give you verbatim our conversation. It's just so burned in you because you're putting forth so much effort to just hit a single shot.
Right. And and Harbortown is not the easiest track in the world either. But for us Germans, I mean, this, you know, it makes the achievement of Bernhard Langer at his age, you know, to walk 72 holes there and contend. You know, and I think he played with Bryson the last round this year, right? In 2020.
He did, and we had a lot of fun in my circle of friends talking about, you know, the difference in distance into the green on a lot of shots. I think one hole, it was upwards of 100 yards, the difference they had into a green. But I do have one Bernhard story from 2016 for your German fans. That was the 30th anniversary of Jack Nicklaus's 1986 win, which many will say either is the greatest Masters Sunday. It may be tied now with the 2019 win for Mr. Woods and what that meant to the game. But in any event, that was the 30th anniversary, 2016. And on Tuesday night, they showed the replay of the final round, and I caught a little bit of it. And on Wednesday morning, I'm on the driving range, And Bernhard is in the first spot right there outside the caddy shack. And I walk out and I turn right to Bernhard and his caddy. And I said, you know, I'm watching that coverage last night and I've seen Mr. Nicholas today. I've seen Billy Kratzer today, who's an announcer who was part of that mix on Sunday. I've seen all these guys that took part in the event, and they all look 30 years older, except for you, Bernhard. You haven't aged a bit. I don't know how you did it, but good on you. And he started laughing and he said, oh, I've aged plenty. So I had a little fun with Bernhard the day after the re-airing of the 1986 Masters. And he was quite gracious, as you would all expect him to be, and quite friendly. And we had a nice little joke at his expense.
He's definitely our athlete of the century here. And even though golf does not get the coverage it deserves and the respect it deserves, I mean, we had Sofia Popov win the Women's Open. She didn't win Athlete of the Year, which I thought was kind of strange. But he does look good, and he's personally responsible for me spending, you know, I guess it must be up to six figures now on this game in the last 40 years. Because when I saw him at St. Andrews, and I didn't really play golf, and I was standing on a hill with like 20 people, and I said on the first hole, he hooked it almost to the wall on the left there to the shops. And I said, hop Bernhard, which means let's go Bernhard. And he's maybe 30, 40 yards away. He turns around. I'm standing in a crowd of 30 people. He looks me straight in the eye and he points at me and he goes like this. And I'm like, how did he know it was me yelling in that crowd? And that's when I got the bug. And I, you know, it was the first, now in Facebook, we all thumb up. But that was to me an amazing moment where I said, maybe this is a cool game. What's happening today at the ladies? Have you gotten any? I haven't been able to check at all. I know we got a couple of German women playing, one who is in the top 10 of the world amateur rankings. They're not playing actually at Augusta, right? The first two rounds, right?
Unfortunately, no. They're playing the first two rounds at Champions Retreat, which is a very, very cool place a little north of Augusta National. They actually had a dinner last night, a chairman's dinner, to kick off the event at Augusta on the grounds of Augusta National. And they took a big photo with all the women, which was really neat. But they're playing today and tomorrow at Champions Retreat. The entire field will then Friday go and play a practice round at Augusta National. And Saturday, the top 30 women will then play a televised round on NBC here in the States and for the championship. And it'll be the second championship. Of course, the first one by Jennifer Kupcho of Wake Forest, where Arnold Palmer also went to school. So that was a neat parallel for the women, their first champ coming from Mr. Palmer's alma mater. But today, right now, the leading score is 4 under par, which when I saw the hole locations today, and I know that golf course they're playing on, I thought 68 was the best possible score. There's one lady at 4, and then tied for second is only 1 under par. So very difficult conditions today. There is a front moving through this area. I've gotten a lot of rain and thunderstorms here at my house. They will be getting that any minute now in Augusta. I'm not sure if they're going to finish the round down there, as a matter of fact. And then we're supposed to get lows below the freezing mark overnight here. So tomorrow it will warm up a little bit, but it'll be a very, very cold, windy day down in Augusta, Georgia. So I would imagine somewhere around even par, maybe 1 under is the lead when they head to Augusta National, where it depends on how they set up the course. Again, the ladies do have somewhat of an advantage where they will see a slightly softer test than the men will see. The rain we're experiencing now and that Augusta's experiencing basically here right now is the last rain that's forecasted through the final round next week. So it's almost a perfect scenario for the superintendents and the agronomists down at Augusta, where they get rain now and then they get to basically slowly tune that place up. And Wednesday afternoon, as we previously discussed, they will basically suck as much moisture as they can out of that ground. And the freezing temperatures actually help too, because that evaporates a lot quicker. So the colder it gets, the better it gets for dryness. So by Sunday afternoon next week, you will see a very, very firm and fast Augusta National, which we did not see in November. Quite soft, course played a little bit longer. It'll play shorter, but it'll play very difficult around the greens. And I wouldn't be surprised to see a single-digit score winning the Masters next week. It'll be a very similar to a Trevor Immelman, Zach Johnson. It could be cold and windy next week. It's supposed to warm up a little, but it's very cold leading up, which usually tells you the course is going to play very difficult.
Did Zach Johnson lay up on all par fives on all 4 days when he won? Is that a myth?
He did, and I believe only three times has the winning score been over par. Zach's one of them. He's the only one this century to have won the tournament with an over par plus one score.
Right. Okay. So you're going to find it difficult and tough. Unfortunately, no Germans are playing. Martin is in a little bit of a slump. Hopefully he'll turn around at some point. You know, you don't win the U.S. Open like he did, with, you know, of wire to wire by seven or something when he won. And just disappear. Well, maybe you do, but I think
right now I'm looking at next Thursday's forecast for Augusta, and it's going to be 74 degrees, going to be a low in the morning in the mid 50s, but the wind is going to be blowing at 9 miles an hour with Augusta at 25 miles an hour. Yeah. So it's going to be, it could be a really, and again, things are obviously subject to change.
Yeah.
But if those winds Friday, there's going to be gusts up to 27 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. So if you get that kind of win, I almost think it's impossible for double digits to be the winning score. It'll be 7, 8, 9 under.
When you prepare, how important is like a morning afternoon start or an afternoon morning start in the first two rounds? Does that sometimes, you know, I guess in Europe maybe more than in the States, because the weather changes more, and usually at the British Open they just have a, you know, first tee start and things like this. That's obviously something that you got to factor in also. I mean, you have no control over that.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get a morning round. You're going to get an afternoon round. It's how bad are the conditions one day to the next. It usually will even out here. As it's cool in the morning, you'll get a little bit calmer weather. And then as it heats up, that's when the winds pick up a little bit. You get more activity in the atmosphere. So every afternoon round will be a little bit more challenging. Obviously, Friday afternoon is going to be a little tougher than Thursday afternoon if the superintendent has their way and they get to gradually, progressively make it harder. So obviously, you want to be late on Thursday, early Friday, if you can help it. That's the better of the draws when it comes to course conditions, but weather could even those things out. You never know. But yeah, the guys that go late Thursday, early Friday on a coin flip usually have a slightly, it's maybe 52% to 48% better chance, those guys that are late early, as opposed to the guys that go off Thursday morning and then could potentially see a completely different course by Friday afternoon.
And trying to make the cut, obviously, then, you know.
And also the guys that finish earlier get the later tee time on Saturday. So those guys that are late early, they finish with the same score as somebody who's early late. They could have an hour difference in tee time on Saturday, which I always like being further back in the pack. So I can now know, okay, is somebody coming to get me? Do I need to make moves early? So on and so forth. So anytime I can get a late early draw, that's the best one to have for me on tour.
Right. Okay. Finally, this could go on all night. It's fascinating stuff. Couple of things that I said. Well, number one, we talked about the golf course. We talked about the myths of Augusta and the history about it. We got to talk about some of the favorites, especially you know, with your knowledge and you know, you're having your finger on the pulse of the way these guys are ticking at the moment. I did warn you, you are now officially in the Golf Show Country Club, which is a club of all the people that have been on the show. We have a Masters special on the 6th where we try to pick a winner.
I'm sure I will finish last, as usually is the case. The more you know, the worse you do.
There you go. But, you know, this is something that I picked up when I lived in the States and we did these Masters pools, these snake drafts, you know. And You know, the days when, you know, in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, when Tiger was just out of the pool because, you know, you couldn't he couldn't lose. But this year, and I'm looking here at some of the chances of that people are given. But you know, basically, you have the top six, which are DJ, Bryson, JT, and John Rahm, Jordan Spieth, and Rory McIlroy. That's like the top six favorites I have here on this list. Obviously, there's one way to approach it. If you're trying to pick a winner, you take out all the guys that play there for the first time, right? Then you take out 80% of the former champions, Sandy Lyle, not winning.
Although I think did he make the cut last year?
I think he did.
Did he make the cut in November?
I think he did. It was a shocker.
Hey, those guys know how to get the ball in the hole. That is still, it doesn't matter how far these guys are hitting it. It's still a game about getting it in a cup.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But if you will, sir, give me two of the favorites and two long shots that you like this week or next week for the green jacket.
Well, I'll tell you who I want to stay away from.
Okay, well, that's a good start.
Rory, he's got too much going on with the swing change, coaching change, just a lot of uncertainty and under pressure. That's when it shows up. And as you've heard Tiger say in the past, you get caught between two swings. I think he's going to have a few of those situations that could lead to some big numbers. Okay. John Rahm, stay away from Rahm right now. His wife is expecting a baby any day now, may not even tee it up. And you don't know how distracted he could be.
Right.
John and his caddy, Adam, again, I've been around him a lot lately. They're maybe one of the best teams in the game, but having a child is just, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. It's his first. So who knows how focused he could be. I would stay away from him simply for that purpose. Obviously he's in good form. He played well in Texas, but who knows how focused he can be on this tournament. I got, you know, after working for him and knowing how easy the course can play for him, Bryson, I'm actually shocked that our T21 and 16 is still his best result. He actually was the leader, I believe, in 2019, the first round leader. And I thought, okay, here's the year where he's really going to have a chance to contend and win. Winning at Winged Foot gets that monkey off his back of never winning a major. And this will be his first Masters after winning the U.S. Open. So maybe that takes a little bit of the edge off of the urgency that he may feel. So I just don't know how you can't go with him. Again, every time he doesn't win a tournament, I'm surprised because I've seen it up close. I know how good he is. I'm also, you know, I feel that way about Dustin. I feel that way about Morikawa and Rahm too. But Bryson has a drive to win at Augusta, maybe unmatched.
Right.
So I think you've got to like him. You know, Justin Thomas kind of getting that monkey off his back with everything he went through earlier in the year with the win at the Players.
Best all-round player for you? Is he
what's
the,
that?
Is he the best all-round player for you, Justin Thomas?
Justin Thomas?
Ball striking wise?
It's a great question. He has the best short game in the world right now. Best scrambler in the world to me is Justin Thomas. Don't know about overall player. You know, the number one player in the world's pretty good.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to, he's just got so many physical gifts. He's one of those guys that just shocks you every time he doesn't win. When a Robert McIntyre is having matches with Dustin Johnson, it's a bit of a surprise because you look at Robert McIntyre and you look at DJ eyeball to eyeball standing right in front of him. And you're like, I don't know how this guy's staying on the golf course with DJ, but he did. That's the beauty of the game. But Justin Thomas and Bryson are two of my favorites. Justin's never really gotten off to a good start at Augusta. We call it Thursday-itis. He just, some reason, just doesn't play great on Thursday and is always playing catch up. And I think he had a decent round this past November, first round, and then kind of struggled maybe somewhere else. Yep. But Justin's another guy. Don't know why he doesn't play better there. He's got all the physical tools, just came off the Players win. So there's some form there. I would discount the match play because it's a bit quirky. The guys that don't play well, you don't know how invested maybe they are at that particular event. Once they lose a match or two, they kind of mail it in. You don't know that, but you can assume that sometimes. So I think Augusta rings Justin's bell. There's a lot of reasons to like him this week. So Bryson and Justin are two of my favorites. Mm-hmm. A dark horse that I think a lot of guys aren't talking about that's actually shown some good form and has a great track record at Augusta is Jason Day. He's healthy. He's got a runner-up finish there. He's played many, many, many times. I think Jason's going to play really well. I think the stars have come together for him. Again, he's healthy again. Talking to his coach, Chris Cuomo, who also coaches Bryson, talking to Chris a couple weeks ago, just a couple of things need work, maybe a little bit of sharpening on the putting game.
Right.
And everything else is really there for Jason right now. So I think Jason Day's a guy I would put in my lineup if I had a chance.
Right. What do you make of Jordan?
Yeah, Jordan. I mean, he's playing great. I was with him in Phoenix. Surprised he didn't win there. I was with him somewhere else, maybe the Players. I've been around Jordan a lot. I was around him a lot in Austin. He knows how to get the ball in the hole.
Right.
Bryson and I played with him the first two rounds in 2016, and Bryson was just filling up the stat sheet. I think the front nine on Thursday, Bryson was 7 for 7 fairways hit, 8 of 9 greens hit. The only green Bryson missed was number 8, and we drove it to about 15 yards in front of the front edge, and we just bounced it over on our third shot. That was the only shot really he missed on the front nine. I think Jordan may hit 1 or 2 fairways, hit 3 greens, and he was 3 under making the turn. We were even par. Bryson had steam coming out of his ears. So Jordan knows how to play Augusta. Yeah. It's just a matter, and he's got his driver kind of controlled a little bit. So, yeah, Jordan's – I think he's going to be a betting favorite just based on his current form
right.
and his success exactly. there. He and Michael do a great job together.
Exactly. Who do you like? Not just for the Masters, but when you look at some of the young guys, you know, and obviously us Europeans, you know, we understand, you know, at least us continental Europeans, that our guys are just can only be good if they play college golf in the States. I'm thinking obviously of Victor Hovland, you know, I don't know which college he played, Arizona.
Oklahoma State.
Unbelievable talent, I think, right? Who do you like, not only of the Europeans, but the young guys that are coming up? And I think Morikawa, you know, is one of them. And even all those other guys, they're not so old. When you talk about DJ and JT and, you know, they're not old guys, but from the young guys.
Looking at the Europeans, I have been impressed from the moment I saw him, I think last year at Wingfoot, Victor Perez.
Right.
Physically the big, guy. Big, yeah. big guy. Yeah. And he's got JP Fitzgerald on the loop, Rory's old caddy.
Okay.
And they were kind of teasing a little bit last week. It may have been off air, but they were kind of teasing saying that might be a better career move for JP going to Victor Perez than it was for Rory ditching him. In hindsight, you know, 5-6 years down the road, you never know. JP may be in a better position with Perez. Big, strong guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to have all the length he's going to need to play there. And JP has been in the final group. We all know about the 2012 collapse of Rory on the back nine, but he's got a guy on the back that was the 54-hole leader at Augusta. So JP has a roadmap to how to get in the final group on a Sunday. And now it's just a matter of can his guy execute if he happens to get him there again. So Victor Perez is a guy I'm pretty high on his stock. Mm. Obviously, Tommy Fleetwood's in a good place. Matt Fitzpatrick has been playing fantastic. Again, has Billy Foster on the bag. Mm. Decades of experience around Augusta. They really work well together. A guy that he doesn't get a lot of coverage in America just simply because he's Korean, Sungjae Im. He's the current Iron Byron. He doesn't miss a shot. He hits a 15-inch cut. When I say 15 inches, it doesn't move 24 inches. It doesn't move 6 inches. It's a 15-inch cut every single shot. It's amazing how repeatable his action is. And at Augusta, you want consistency. You want the more opportunities you get, the higher your odds are of success. He's going to get his opportunities. So Sungjae Im's a guy and another guy from
– Right? He's a young
kid. What's that?
He's a young kid, Sungjae. He's like
– Oh, yeah. He's 24, 25. I mean, he's
like that. Yeah. Yeah, kid.
He's right in that same vein with all the other guys. And another guy that's been playing really good, that's ascended into the world rankings pretty high, that I think you need to keep an eye on, He's kind of the modern day Lee Trevino is Abraham Answer.
Yes.
He's a guy I really think could play well. He was very, very upset when he lost his match, his playoff last week in Austin. He really should have gotten into the knockout stages, got a bad break. Kevin Streelman made a long one on him in a playoff. He was fired up going back to the clubhouse. So this is a guy that just last week was pretty angry about a good result. So look for him to keep grinding and play well at Augusta. And the guy caddying for him, a guy named Benji Thompson, who was an Augusta National Club caddy, may know the golf course better than any other caddy in the field. That's the guy looping for Abe Answer. So there's kind of a little inside baseball on a pick.
This is the money ball. Is what.
And again, all this knowledge I have, don't be surprised if I finish last in the pool.
Well, there you go. It's, it's when you overthink and you over research and do things like this. It's definitely, worldwide, a high sports highlight every year. It actually gets coverage in the mainstream media in Germany. We're the second biggest golf federation in Europe. We have 700,000 golfers here. We have 1,000 clubs, or 1,000 courses, 700 clubs. We're the second biggest golf federation in Europe after the British. We don't get to see the Masters on free TV. It's on Sky Sports. We had my friend Gregor, who is the German commentator for Sky Sports, on the podcast as well.
Is Paul McGinley on Sky Sports?
He's on the English thing. I'm talking about the German.
Paul's on BBC. He's not on Sky.
I don't know. I watch the German stuff.
I know Rich Beam does Sky Sports, right?
I don't know. Where's Butch Harmon?
Butch does Sky, and I think Rich Beam is their on-course commentator out with feature groups, because Rich is always working with me and Bones. Wherever end up going, it seems like we're always with Rich with Sky Sports. Right. And my joke to Rich is, hey, do you need my routing information so Sky Sports can send me a direct deposit for all the work I do for you? And I always tease Rich about that. So I think he's the guy. The information you get from Rich Beam at Sky Sports, that's also coming from me.
There you go. Well, let's see if the Germans are willing to pony up something for
there you go. That'd be great.
They're sitting in a basement in Munich commentating, from a golf course they've never been to. So
they can patch me through on a Zoom meeting, and I'll be the local expert.
Now we're talking. Drew, there's so many things, but I've taken too much of your time. I hope you do come back. I want to talk to you about things, about the distance report, about measuring devices. You guys now being, there's just a ton of stuff to talk about. And we'll save that for the next time. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I mean that. You taking the time, even on short notice, before the Masters. You got a couple of women or girls. I mean, some of these women playing in the amateur. They are the number one amateur in the world is 15, right? She just,
yeah, I think so. And one of the players that I'm consulting with is Caterina Don from Italy, so European. Yeah. So
there you go. Yeah. And at the Ryder Cup, we're going to have some talks before that, you and me.
Sounds good. I'll be there working.
There you go. Listen, I wish you nothing but the best. Major respect. Thank you for sharing your insight. I will send you the details about what's going on the 6th. If you have time to jump on, it would be great. Meet the other fellows and give my best to Georgia. Give my best to the country I love that I miss living in, and enjoy Masters Week. And I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Frank, auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen. Mach's gut, mein Bester. Take care. Bye.